This is Steve Maxner conducting an interview with Captain James Mulligan on the 13th of March 2001 at approximately 2 o'clock. We are in Virginia Beach, Virginia, in Captain Mulligan's home. Sir, why don't we go ahead and begin by discussing your personal history a little bit. When and where you were born, where you grew up.
Okay, I was born in Lawrence, Massachusetts, 1926, and I was always interested in flying and always interested, particularly interested in the Navy. World War II came along, and when I was 17, with the threat of turning 18 and getting drafted, I was in high school at the time. I applied and was accepted to the Navy V-5 Aviation Cadet Training Program, and I went in at age 17, and I was sworn in on the 9th of February 1944 in my senior year at high school. I went through flight training, and the war ended. And I was a contract officer. I received my wings in 1947, and I served till November 1949 when my contract expired. And the Navy, and everybody had a big downturn at that time under the Louis Johnson era. The military was really cut back. So I left the Navy and went back to school, but immediately joined a fighter squadron. I was Squadron, and I flew courses, F4U courses on a Squadron and a fighter squadron, and I was there for 6 months. We were flying every weekend, and Korea broke open. When Korea broke open, I volunteered to go back in active duty sending a telegram in, and I was accepted, and I came back in active duty. I was the first individual recalled on the East Coast as far as aviators went. I was assigned to a composite squadron 12 at up at Quonset Point, Rhode Island, and which was an airborne early warning squadron. It was the predecessor of the present Navy AWACS. Mm-hmm. We did the development work in that. I made six and a half month med cruise in numerous small time departments. At the end of 2 years, I returned from active duty to college, mm-hmm. and went back in fighter squadrons again, flew courses, and then we transitioned to jets when I was in the reserve squadron. I got my degree in history in 1955 and came back on active duty, and was assigned to Pensacola, mm-hmm. where I was the officer in charge of a formation squadron that did train students in formation flying. And then when we closed, I flew the last SNJ Texan Op, Fisher One in the Navy, mm-hmm. when we closed that field. And then I moved over and I was the operations officer for the instructors training group for a year. And then I was transferred up here to Oceana, where I was a member of the first replacement air training squadron. And I got 2 years of shore duty, sea duty ashore, because I was qualified for being the instructor training operations officer in Pensacola. And the Navy was just switching over at that time to a standardization program. Mm-hmm. So I was there for 2 years, and I spent a couple of years as an operations officer. VA-72 aboard the USS Independence. I made 3 med cruises with them, the Bad Pigs cruise and the missile cruiser, Cuban Missile Crisis cruise also. Then I was assigned as the VFVA NATOPS coordinator out of Washington, D.C. My primary job at that time was redoing all the fighter and attack jet flight manuals. Mm-hmm. For 18 months I was up there. I came back and I had 5.5 months at the Armed Forces Staff College, and I was assigned to VA-36 and A-4 Squadron when I was the executive officer on the Saratoga out of Mayport, Florida. Mm-hmm. Finished one med cruise with that outfit, and we were transferred to the USS Enterprise. We picked up the Enterprise in September of 65 and went over to Vietnam, and I was shot down on the 20th of March of 66 on my 80th flight, the day before I was taken over as the squadron commander. So that technically ended my, really ended my flying career, because when I got back I was really so senior that I couldn't have a flying billet.
Yes, sir. Yeah. Let me take a step back real quick. I'm curious why you decided to join the Navy at the age of 17.
Well,
was it
Navy
family
was,
tradition? Or?
Yeah, I always liked the Navy, okay? I liked the idea of carrier flying, particularly. I always, as far as the military went, I wouldn't have thought of going into any other service but the Navy.
Okay.
That's just the way it was. Mm-hmm. I always liked the Navy, and I wanted to go to the Navy. In fact, I had an opportunity to go to the Naval Academy several times, and I elected not to do that because the war was on. But I had distant relatives that had been in the Navy. I had gone to the Naval Academy. I had a lot of friends who had been in the Navy, and particularly in World War II. A lot of my friends who were older than I were went into naval aviation.
Mm-hmm.
So I really wanted to go into naval aviation.
Okay. What did you think about the use of atomic weapons in the Second World War when you heard that those bombs had been dropped on Hiroshima?
It was the greatest thing in the world, okay?
Yes, sir.
It ended the war. I was just a kid. I was stationed in San Diego at that time, doing what we called tarmac duty, and just before going to pre-flight.
Mm-hmm.
And we really expected to lose a lot of people in Japan.
Yes.
And when the atomic weapon was used, I and the whole United States applauded very heavily that we had done that and ended that war. And thank God we had it and ended it, because if it had been the other way around, I don't think we'd have been treated anywhere near as well as we treated the Japanese had they won the war.
That's right. That's you raise an interesting question. What did you think about the American policies that evolved after the Second World War with regard to Germany and Japan, and especially the Marshall Program, and of course, very similar program for Japan to rebuild?
Oh, right. The Marshall Program was a tremendous program, and MacArthur did a good job with the Japanese. I mean, brought them into the real world and civilized that country. That country was an advanced country, but they're very barbaric, okay? If you study the history of the Japanese fighting in China, Southeast Asia, also what they did to some of our American prisoners, which was very well hid by our government for many, 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 many years, okay? Mm-hmm. Japanese were very barbaric people. When they lost that war so bad, MacArthur shaped them up real fast. Probably the best thing he ever did was getting Japan back on its feet and getting it so that it's more or less a very free democratic country. Okay? Mm-hmm. He did a lot to that culture. And of course, I was very much in favor of the Marshall Plan and anything we could do. I was early on, I recognized the problem that we were engaged in the Cold War. I remember Churchill's speech at Independence, Missouri, and about the Iron Curtain. And I didn't have any doubts that it was going to be a war between two systems, the socialist system and the communist Russia and ourselves. Okay. And that's probably one of the reasons that I opted to be a career officer. And I came back in and stayed in, because I always felt that that was a part of my legacy, was to make sure that the world ended up free and my kids didn't have to go through that thing.
Yes, sir. Okay. Now, When you went back in and during the Korean War, what aircraft did you fly and where were you stationed out of?
I ended up being stationed at Quonset Point, Rhode Island, and I flew the Douglas Sky Raider and the very first versions of the AD-3W, which had a APS-20 radar, big dish underneath it, okay? We did the pioneer work in ASW and airborne early warning. BC-12, and we split off. We got rid of the ASW mission and the submarine mission, and we picked up on the airborne early warning mission, okay, and search mission. So we were attached to fast carriers as detachments, and I made a 6.5 7-month med cruise on the USS Coral Sea when they had a major problem in the eastern end of the Mediterranean, and it looked like there were going to be some hostilities that might involve the Russians, and we deployed very quickly. We were also the first carrier that had atomic weapons with us at that time. Now, the airplanes that were going to fly use those atomic weapons were not based aboard the ship. They were based at Port Lyoti. Mm-hmm. They would fly out to the ship, and then they would land on the ship, get loaded on the ship, and then take off on their missions if they had to use them.
Yes, sir.
At that time. But then of course, we went through the exercise where they mm-hmm. came out and landed on the ship, loaded, offloaded them, and did their deal. But that was a very interesting part of the, in a very precarious part of our history. Korea was going on, and there was a lot of things going on in the Med.
Mm-hmm.
In Greece almost went completely communist in 1949, mm-hmm. 48, 49. So it was a very precarious situation. Air power was pretty important over there.
Sure. Now, was this, to your understanding, this is the first deployment of nuclear weapon or atomic weapons on board ship for aircraft
right
use?
Right, on the USS Coral Sea.
Wow.
Yeah, and that was in 1951, out of
Norfolk. How much were you aware of this at the time? Completely aware? Or was it pretty hush-hush?
Very hush-hush. The airplanes that were going to, you never even saw them. They kept them in the hangars. They flew them at night at Norfolk, and then they flew them. I saw them at Port Lyoti. Because I happened to go into Port Lyoti.
Mm-hmm.
Rick, and I forget the name of a particular airplane. It was, it had a jet and a tail.
Mm-hmm.
Two big props.
Mm-hmm.
If I didn't have a little senior moment, now I even remember the name and the designation of the airplane when I can't.
It's okay.
Call it on top of my head. But I remember when we went down to the, we were down in Norfolk to get ready aboard the ship. It only takes a week or so, but everybody comes in and stuff. There was a tremendous amount of security. We didn't know what the security was for.
Okay.
Things at night, much more than we've ever seen before. And of course, when we were, and we still didn't know the weapons were on board until we had an exercise where the aircraft actually came up, flew in from Port Lyoti, landed on the ship, and when they landed on the ship, I happened to be not be flying at that particular time, and they brought these weapons up from below decks under complete security, shrouded with Marines all over the place, and so you couldn't see anything. You had no idea what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And it would get up real fast. It was sometimes bombs. I mean, what kind of bomb it was.
Yes, sir.
Went too hard to figure that out.
Mm-hmm.
But the security was very, very tough.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Now, when you went back to school, let's see, you were probably in school from around 53 to 55?
Yeah, I went back at the end of 52 to 55, right, and then I flew in a fighter squadron up at, we moved from squadron to Weymouth, mm-hmm. South Weymouth. And I flew Corsairs, F-44s, FG, mm-hmm. 1Ds, which were the Goodyear version of the Corsair.
Yes,
and then we transitioned to F-9, F-6s, which were, let's see, we flew Panthers.
Mm-hmm.
Cougars, they were really Cougars. Okay, it was the swept wing version.
Mm-hmm. Where did you go to school?
Marymount College in Massachusetts, Andover, Massachusetts.
Okay.
That's where I finished up, yeah.
Yes, sir. While you were there, a couple of interesting events, of course, occurred in Southeast Asia. The fall of Dien Bien Phu and the Geneva Accords.
Yeah, 54. I was
yes,
quite
sir.
Aware of that.
Yeah, I was curious what you thought of that at the time and if it was discussed much.
Well, I was a history major, of course, and so I was quite aware of what was going on. There was a question in everybody's mind whether the U.S. was going to do anything on the Dien Bien Phu thing.
Mm-hmm.
I early on thought that there was going to be a problem, a communist problem in Asia, which would be directly related to the Cold War, similar to the Eastern European nations after World War II.
Mm-hmm.
It was my concept. Later people discussed this theory as a domino theory.
Mm-hmm.
I felt pretty much that in Vietnam and in Laos and Cambodia, that was probably starting to emerge. And I was in Washington, of course, when Kennedy was assassinated. I went to Washington in January of 63,
mm-hmm.
okay, after Kennedy had been elected the year before. And he took office in January of 62,
mm-hmm.
so I remember, right, 61. Yeah, he was elected in 61. He took
yes,
in 61 as an
amendment mm-hmm.
when he took over, okay. But, you know, we were quite aware that they were putting a few people in there, and initially it didn't work out of Vietnam. It was on Laos. Kennedy's first year was on Laos
mm-hmm.
and stuff in Vietnam. But I, from my own studies, I felt that it was a continuation of the Cold War in that the communist system was expanding in Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, when after Kennedy was assassinated and Johnson took over, Johnson took over and I got transferred from Washington in the end of June of 64. So I spent the next 5.5 months at the Armed Forces Staff College, and the interesting thing about that was no one ever talked about Vietnam out there or what was happening. We had visiting speakers that came in from the Westpac and stuff, but the one thing we know now that the president put the lid on him and nobody was able to say anything. Okay, but Johnson had that whole thing wrapped up politically and everybody kept their mouth shut. In fact, it was the first time I was really aware that anything big was going on in Vietnam was when I was in the Med on the Saratoga
mm-hmm.
in the spring of 1965. And we got my Air Wing Commander got a letter from the Air Wing Commander off the Ranger. I think he was off the Ranger. A man that I had known. He had been with me in VC-12 at Quonset Point, so I knew him quite well.
Mm-hmm.
He was a good friend of mine. And he told about all the problems that were going on and that the war was really heating up. And we were in the Med, we had no idea what was going on. He didn't have a clue.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And he later got killed over there. So we became aware in the spring of 65, and as I said, it was the best kept secret even in the military. Because no one talked about it. Yeah.
Well, a number of other events, significant events, and you've already mentioned them briefly, that occurred in the early 60s, of course, the Bad Pigs.
I was down there for the Bad Pigs. Unfortunately, they didn't use us. Let's see, the other carrier was down there. I don't remember if it was the Intrepid or the Essex.
Mm-hmm.
But the Independence was down there. And,
okay.
You know, we knew that there was some type of hostilities going on. We were aware of what Castro had for defenses.
Mm-hmm.
We expected that we would probably be called in to take out those defenses. And we weren't.
Were you surprised that you weren't called in to help?
Yeah, I'm definitely surprised when they went through with the invasion, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And when they invaded and we didn't have any air power, I was really mm-hmm. surprised about that. Because, as I understood, they wrapped them up on the beaches pretty much. And later on, of course, some of the people, one of the guys who was on the Independence later on was a Marine captain who was in charge of a group of people that tried to get as many of those people out of there as they could. They wanted to get as many of those people out as they could. They got some, they didn't get that many. But I had talks with him and he indicated that they got zapped on the beaches and didn't have any air power and were wiped. And I think it was probably a disastrously planned thing to start out with. It was a CIA operation that fell flat on its ass. I don't think President Kennedy was completely fully aware of what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard that at the Armed Forces Staff College later on when one of the one of the guys from the CIA was a speaker, and we asked him a question about that. And he said, well, the lesson of the Bay of Pigs was that the CIA would never again lie to the President of the United States. So I indicated to me that they didn't quite give them the necessary information that they should have, you know.
Mm-hmm, yes, sir.
But I felt that I felt bad for the Cubans because they got zapped, and you know it was a time. The problem was with Castro. When Castro came to power, it was really interesting because the American people were on his side against Batista and stuff. And of course, he immediately flipped over into being a communist leader after he got in power. Mm-hmm. But at the time. I think he had popular support inside it. And if we could have made an accommodation and got him with us at that time, they'd have been a hell of a lot better off. But he was lined up with the other system. He's a real socialist style. But our people didn't know that. And that was bad intelligence on our part, I think. Okay. But I have always felt that our policy towards Cuba was stupid. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I think this idea of isolating. Actually, the Cubans didn't do anything for them or for us.
Yes.
If I was running foreign policy, I'd be very careful about sanctions. Mm-hmm. Sanctions don't work on anybody. Only do it hurt people at the bottom, never hurt people at the top. Sanctions on Libya doesn't bother Libya, doesn't bother Iraq, doesn't bother anybody.
Mm-hmm.
The people that 2 or 3 or 4% around those countries get in touch with the rest of the people.
Yes, sir.
And that's personal opinion. I don't like sanctions. I think you open them up and they'll collapse.
Mm-hmm.
I feel, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think we'd open up Cuba years and years ago. Castro would be gone. My opinion.
Yes, sir. Now, on the subject of Cuba, of course, a major diplomatic and potential military concern was the Cuban Missile Crisis, 1962.
That was the whole thing. That was interesting.
Yeah. Why don't you describe where you were and what your perspective was at the time?
I was in the process of getting transferred to go to Washington to pick up the NATO's job. And I was officer 72. We had a new skipper who had little experience. I hadn't been to sea much. Ex-soldier, I hadn't had that much experience. And I could have chose not to go with the ship and go down to Cuba. But we didn't know where we were going to start. The ship caught a deployment order right here, out at the Independence. And the day they got that thing and to deploy order, that they were loading one day and leaving the next. I could have gone to Washington. I was talking to Washington and they said, hey, they'll bring you right up here right now, and and I said, no, I can't do that. The ship's going out. I didn't know what they're going up. We didn't have a clue what they're going up. So, but I knew what they're going up theoretically for a couple of weeks, and so I went. I stayed as ops officer and went out there. Well, as soon as we, all of a sudden, what was a non-urgent quick deployment became an urgent deployment. I mean, they said, well, we zapped out of here. Next thing, so we went rolling out. And we started heading south. I had left one pilot back here because I had one airplane that was up at rework up at Quonset Point. And I told him, I said, I want you to fly up to Quonset Point, pick up the airplane, and come down and catch us. I said, well, we'll be south someplace. Go to Jacksonville and find out where you're at. He went to Jackson. They said go to Key West. He went to Key West, and that way he eventually found us. But it was a week later. In the meantime, the week that we're going down there, we start playing like mad, and we got some initial intelligence. And the intelligence was that the Russians were in the process of putting in missile sites. And I can tell you right now, the target I had was a place called Los Angeles Banes, in Banes, and not too far from Guantanamo. But the very first picture I had that came through was a big picture of a bunch of fields.
Mm-hmm.
with nothing in them. Just fields. And it said possible missile selection site. Type of deal. And then the next day we got pictures and there was heavy equipment moving in and there were bulldozers moving in. And we saw them putting in a SAM site. And they had also right next to the place there's water. It was right next to the water. They had Russian PT boats type deals, coma boats or stuff. Mm-hmm. And then they started putting in it every day. The work that was going on, all the stuff that was going on in that particular deal. So we knew our own guys were doing the flying. A lot of the photo work was being done by our own photo people. Mm-hmm. Okay, and they were covering that stuff. And we knew it was big time because they painted out all the numbers. Okay. We didn't go anywhere near Cuba. The ship didn't, and we steered around and went way south, 150 to 200 miles. So we stayed down there. And in the meantime, our intelligence started increasing all the time. And it suddenly popped up that there was the missile crisis, and we were aware of what was going on. The ships were still coming, carrying the big missiles, theoretically.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to turn around. I always remember the day we got the the CO decided that I should lead the A-plane strike against Los Angeles punished if we were going to get launched, and that was our target. And so we got briefed for it and everything, and we were standing by, and we went to a ready alert, and then we went to the pilot's manual planes. In the Navy, you don't start up the airplanes until you're a couple, 3 minutes from launch. Okay, ship gets up speed, and turns into the wind, mm-hmm. and you go. So that's what happened. The ship got up speed. We started up the airplanes. Okay, for launch, we turned into the wind. We got on the cats. Okay, and it was sure and shit. I was going, and the plan was go take out this target, come back, reconfigure for nuclear weapons. The ship would go right to Atlantic launch area. We had a launch area in Atlantic World Office, had personal targets in Russia. That was the game plan. So I turned up my engine, and I was on the number two cat to go.
Mm-hmm.
I had four of my planes turning up and four right behind them. Okay, and we were loaded up there. And when you start, you're turning up and you get ready to launch, and they start winding you up. Well, they start winding me up and getting ready to go, and they're winding me up, and over the bullhorn it says, Washington has just given us a hold to hold in place. That they've stopped and turned around. So we knew what it was to stop and turn around. So we held in place, and we kept turning up for about another 15 to 20 minutes on the cats with all bombs. I said, okay, I'm going to shut down the airplane, shut down the aircraft, and stay. We'll go back to the radio, keep everything as go.
Mm-hmm.
They put us on a hold, okay, and stand on a hold, which be ready just to go in case we have. So that's how close it was as far as I was concerned. Okay. Hard to believe that, but that's as close as it was. On the U.S. Independence, and I was there. And I was leading that flight, that first strike on that first target.
Mm-hmm.
And we had other planes behind us, we're going to hit other targets, but there I was on the first one. So I figured that we got kind of close.
Have you seen that recent movie done on the Cuban Missile Crisis?
No, I haven't. I'm going to. I haven't seen it.
Just curious what your perspective was in terms of historical accuracy.
There are some interesting things about one of the things that happened. We were in the South, and of course, we were down there fast.
Mm-hmm.
So we picked the area south of Cuba is relatively shallow waters in a lot of places. But there's one place that had real deep water, and we wanted to have deep water for the carrier. And we were 170 miles, 200 miles south of Gitmo. It is a great big deep area. And we hadn't been flying for some days, and they decided that we should do a minimum amount of flying just to keep up the proficiency at that time down there. Hmm. So we were sitting down there, and I'd fly, four guys in the morning, and four guys before noon, four guys after noon, and four guys. I was in the last four. We had a couple of destroyers with us, and the first night we were down there, the destroyers thought they had a submarine contact behind a carrier. Mm-hmm. And then they lost it. They said they thought they had something. They didn't. That was the first thing, first night we were there. And the second night, so around 6 or 7 o'clock, they thought they heard something again. And so that was 48 hours. And the third night, they thought they heard something. Every time they make a run to see what they had, they'd lose it. Hmm. So the admiral got smart. We had a real smart admiral running that show. So what they did, they launched the airborne early warning guys and the ASW guys were combined in the same plane. And they had sonar buoys, passive sonar buoys, okay? Mm-hmm. And so they knew this spot where they were getting these pings, okay? So we got away from there, and we got the destroyers away from there. And I was coming in, I was coming back in, and just before it was dark, it was around 7 o'clock at night, 6 or 7 o'clock at night. And I was the last jet coming in to land. Just little. You know, it was just to keep your proficiency up. Really, that's all. I was just flying around for now. And the guys who were in the airborne early warning ASW, were in my red room. We only had four airplanes and six pilots. Okay, but they shared our ready room with us, so I know these guys real well, and I knew what they were going to do. So they sat out there, and they dropped some sonar buoys, and they're passive, okay? Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, I'm coming in the land, and I just get said, "Holy shit, he's coming up! He's coming up!" And they hit, "We got him! We got him! He's coming up!" Of course, I come in and land, okay? Mm-hmm. And the ship was steaming away, and these guys are way back here. It's this goddamn submarine pops up, okay? And as soon as it pops up, they're sitting on top of them with the flares. They just grab flares and take this picture. It was the first Type 21 nuclear submarine the Russians had. We had never had a picture of it. We kept it down 96 hours. And he came up, and the reason he came up was because they didn't have any method of communicating underwater. They had to come up to get the 7 o'clock Fox schedule out of Leningrad to find out if the war was on.
Well,
okay, that was interesting.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, it was really
that was fascinating.
That was a real interesting deal, and the admiral was very pleased that they had kept that mother down 96 hours and forced them to come up.
Mm-hmm.
And it took his picture.
Yeah. Was there any did the subcommander get out? Was there?
Oh no. Jesus, what are they gonna? They pop up at this stage again. You get their radios going to find out what the hell's going on, and as soon as they pop out, the flares are off, and you know, mm-hmm. what are you going to do? You're dead. And mm-hmm. they got their signals and went down again, of course, you know. But
that's amazing.
That's pretty interesting. But it was, the other story was I sent Johnny D. Tate to pick up the airplane up at Quonset Point, because his wife had just had a baby. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Stay home a couple of days and go to Quonset Point and pick up the plane and come back." And I said, "You know, we're down there someplace." So he flies back, and he goes from Quonset Point to Norfolk. he got to Norfolk and kept on going, went to Jacksonville. He said, couldn't see a Navy ship anyplace. There was nothing anyplace. He went to Jacksonville and he landed at Jacksonville and said, "We'll find out where the Independence was." And I said, "Well, we don't know. Go to Key West." He said, "He went to Key West." He said, "They landed at Key West and there are hundreds of Air Force and Navy planes all over the place." He says, mm-hmm. "No ships. You can't see a ship anyplace." So he landed there at Key West, got gas, and they said to him, "Well, why don't you go to Guantanamo? They'll probably know of Guantanamo." Mm-hmm. So he flies to Guantanamo, and when he's at Guantanamo, he puts on a ship's TACAM, because it's up at 30,000 feet. He picks us up 180 miles away, and he called the ship. He mm-hmm. said, "I'm over Guantanamo." And what do you want me to do? And I happened to be up there when he called in, and I said to the old man, hey, we got a clear deck, can we bring him in? He said, yeah. I said, okay, he'll be here, give him 30 minutes or so. I said, well, come on out. And so he just kept on coming, came and landed. Of course, when he landed, he came in, holy shit. He says, hey, God, what the hell's going on? He said, every goddamn ship, there's nothing in the harbor anyplace.
Wow.
And he said, and airplanes all over Florida. He says, hundreds and hundreds of airplanes. Yeah. That's how we get the clue. Excuse me a second.
Oh,
get rid of some coffee.
Go ahead, sir.
So the missile crisis was a real fascinating part of my career because we were smack right in the middle of it from start to finish. And the interesting thing about it was that politically I had been paying attention to it because I forget the guy from New York, the senator from New York, a Republican. Had been talking about the Russians were bringing missiles in all that summer. Okay.
Yes, sir.
And that had been put. He'd been raising hell about that. I forget this guy's name, but he had some inside information that they were moving stuff in. Actually, mm-hmm. I find out now they actually had more than they thought they did at that time. So that was a pretty interesting deal. And of course, at that particular time, light attack. We were 99%. Special weapons and 10% conventional weapons.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we were geared for atomic weapons.
Okay,
that was almost our whole mission. As a matter of fact, I had nuclear targets from 1960 to 1965. In 1965, I finally turned my Russian targets over to a Polaris submarine. Normally, in the med, one carrier relieves another, and you'd come in from another squadron and relieve me, and I would give you my two targets,
mm-hmm.
okay, and you would pass them on to the next guy that relieved you. But in '65, on Saratoga, when I finished, when we were coming back, we didn't pass them off to aviators. They went over to Polaris submarines. Submarines took over,
okay,
which was the end of special weapons for the small attacks. You know, which
yes, sir. Now, when you mentioned before that your initial targets were obviously on Cuba, and then you had targets after that for Russia. So,
yeah.
Technically, the war was going to be not just fought, but even as
well,
while you were in the area.
We expected, and the ship expected, that what they told us was that after the launch, the first launch, we would recover. The ship would then head for its launch point off of Norway.
Yes, sir.
Okay. And we would reconfigure our aircraft. Well, you have changed the wiring,
mm-hmm.
back to the nuclear weapons wiring, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And we would, and there's a launch point up there, and all the attack people had nuclear target. You had one target for each pilot.
Yes, sir.
Okay. You know, single engine pilots and stuff. You know.
Yes, sir.
But that was the game plan. That's what they told us was going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Have you heard the more recent revelation that there were some short-range missiles apparently launchable already on the island when we were getting ready to hit?
Well, that's what I've heard recently, and that's what I think that the guy from New York was talking about,
okay.
when they hushed him up.
Yes, sir.
I forget this guy.
It wasn't Rockefeller.
No. I'd have to go back and start thinking of those years I haven't thought about, he was very vociferous. He had a lot of information. He kept yakking about it, and they kept shutting him up. But he obviously knew what was going on. He lost the election too.
Okay.
If I think about it long enough,
yes,
I'll get his name right. I haven't been focused. You got to focus on that, you know.
Yes, sir. Okay. Well, between the Cuban Missile Crisis and your arrival in Southeast Asia, was there anything that you wanted to do? Well, yeah.
I went to Washington and I did the NATOP stuff up in Washington.
Yeah, the standardization of the manuals.
Right, that was quite interesting.
Well, why don't we go ahead and talk about that, because that's got some applications for today.
Yeah, well, the Navy decided that we had to have a NATOP program, which is Naval Aviation and Standardization Operating Procedures. And so up until that time, each squadron had its own doctrine, how they did things.
Mm-hmm.
We said, wait a minute, if you're flying the same type of airplanes, there ought to be one best way of doing it, right? So what we did was we took the the high time people with experience in airplanes, okay? I took them and I would, for example, in Douglas on the A-4s, I'd have a conference at Douglas. It would probably take 2 weeks, okay? I'd bring 10 or 12 guys in there. Top from the East Coast, West Coast, all squadrons. And we'd sit down with the engineers and then we'd go through the handbook. Okay, let's start with the flight manual. Mm-hmm. And page one, and you know, see how it's written. Well, most handbooks are written by tech writers before that. And we decided it would be better to have the aviator language in there, okay? And so we did. We rewrote the handbooks. And we had technical advice with us all the time. We had the advantage of having, we had tech writers right with us, but also we had engineering support from the company, okay? So that we could say, well, what's the best way of doing this procedure or that procedure? And we would hammer it out, okay? Because there's a lot of experience and a lot of stuff that the company would recommend one way and the experience had shown was another way is better, okay? Because we had the guys with experience who had lots of time. They're all high-time people in the aircraft. Mm-hmm. So that enabled us to redo the flight manuals. And part of the things we had to do was to declassify the confidential manuals because a lot of the emergency procedures were classified at that time. So we declassified that stuff and put them in the flight manual. And that flight manual then gave you the procedures of everybody did it the same way, okay?
That's right.
And then each squadron had its own standardization officer, so that they trained right out of the flight manual, and he, you know, it was like reading the Bible. This is the A4 Bible, and this is how we start the airplane, and this is, you know, this is how we taxi it, and this is what we do. And this deal, if we have this emergency, this is the way it's handled, okay? So that was really interesting because I had a short period of time. And I did all the fighter and all the attack aircraft, the jet fighter and jet attack aircraft, in 18 months. That was my number one goal. Mm-hmm. And so it kept me very busy. I traveled an awful lot. Had unlimited budget. I worked out of Grumman, North American Columbus, mm-hmm. Lockheed, Chanceport, I think Temco down there in Dallas. And Douglas, and I did all their jets, the single engine and the multi-engine jets. And it was really, I had an unlimited budget for travel, mm-hmm. and I could sit down and write a set of, get maybe year, when I did the A3s, mm-hmm. which was the Douglas A3s, we had a version of what they call the Q-planes, which were out, and some of them were in Rota, Spain, and some of them were in the factory, and some mm-hmm. of them were over in the Pacific. And I had a couple of guys in Rota, Spain. I just wrote them. I wrote Rota, Spain, the CEO, and said, I want you to send this guy and this guy to this conference for 2 weeks. Okay? And they had to send them. I just wrote the orders for them. I could find out who really knew what was going on and mm-hmm. pull them in and that type of deal. You know, it was a good way of doing things. We got it done fast. We could have built a bureaucracy out of it and taken 3 to 5 years to do it. Well, we throw the money at it and do it. Mm-hmm. So we threw the money at it and did it. The money was travel money. Toughest shore duty I ever had. My wife said to me she would be more than happy if I go back to sea duty because I would leave on Sunday night. I'd come back normally on Thursday or Friday. And, you know, I'm out at the factory. When you're at the factory, and when I was out doing it, I had the check with me, paying for the manuals, that type of thing. I had the contract in my little grubby hand. That's how I got it done so fast. Right. Well, so you're out there, so you have to go to lunch. You got to go to dinner. Mm-hmm. I want to come home and put my old clothes on, suck on a beer, play with the kids. She wants to go out, you know. 18 months of that, she said, boy, she was so glad when I got back on sea duty, get away from that stuff.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
What were some of the biggest lessons you took away from that experience in terms of being able to work and get kind of job done quickly?
Oh, yeah, get things done. Yeah. I learned that money talks.
Hmm.
Okay? We were revising a program that had been in effect for 25 years. Flight manual program, and everybody did it the same way. It was you kicked it over to the manufacturer, and he did what he did and put his tech writers and that type of deal. Mm-hmm. So the very first time that this happened was we announced that we were going to do this deal. Grumman was the very first company. Mm-hmm. And Grumman had... So I called up Grumman and said, look, I'm so-and-so, the new project manager. I'm going to have a conference. I want you guys to host this conference. Up here at Grumman, I'm going to bring 14 guys in. We're going to go through the F9F manual. We're going to rewrite it and all that type of stuff. And everything's fine. Mm-hmm. And, they said, well, you know, we don't have a contract. I said, don't worry about it. You'll get the contract. I'll take care of that. I don't have time to bullshit around. So I scheduled a contract. Okay, so I send everybody orders, and everybody's getting ready. They're going to start coming in on Sunday. And it's Thursday, and I go out to lunch on Thursday, and when I come back from lunch, my office gets a call from Grumman, and Grumman said that they canceled the contract, canceled the conference, because they didn't have a conference. They didn't have a contract. Or they weren't going to hold a conference. So we had done our research, and I talked to the contracting lady who was in charge of the contracts. Mm-hmm. And I called her up and I said, Grumman has canceled my contract. We had gone up and told her what we were going to do, mm-hmm. and how she was going to have to help us out to get it done by time frame, and she agreed to this. And Grumman would not go along with canceled conference because they didn't have a contract. And I said, well, what can I do? She said, well, you're a project officer. She says, all you have to do is tell me that you don't want them working under their present contract. Okay? I will call the Navy at Grumman right now. The Navy will go out and they'll walk in that building and turn the lights off. I said, that's what I want you to do. And she said, fine. An hour later, I'm getting this frantic call from mm-hmm. Grumman, mm-hmm. and they say, this type of deal. I said, well, you canceled the conference. I said, I'm coming up on Sunday. And, well, we'd like you to reinstate our conference so we can work through Friday and stuff. I said, you don't have a contract. Your contract's dead. I said, the next contract you're going to have is my contract, okay? And my contract isn't going to come until I have my conference. Well, they're shut down cold. Everybody goes home. Okay, all the tech writers, all the people working. I mean, big building. Friday. So I went up there Sunday. All my guys come in Sunday, and they really bebopped in on Sunday. Mm-hmm. And it arrived, and they picked us up. And was very leery and very apprehensive. And, you know, well, shit to this guy. You know, mm-hmm. type of deal. So we get the cops. In the meantime, I had made arrangements with this lady. And this lady, she was the person. Mm-hmm. See, you have to know the person with the money. She was the person with the contract. She put the contract out, typed it, and put her little stamp on that thing. That's it. You got paid. Mm-hmm. So I told her, I said, now, Roz, you got to do me a favor. I said, I'm going to be in that meeting at Grumman. I said, I want you to make sure that you deliver that contract to me Monday morning in the middle of that meeting. Okay? She said, no problem, I'll have it there. I'm in the middle of this meeting, and the Grumman people were unhappy. They don't know if they're getting paid. Mm-hmm. It's new. We don't like change. We've always done it this way, all this bullshit. I got all my guys there, and they're really digging into it, you know. We're into about an hour, and all of a sudden, I was, at that time, lieutenant commander. I was just getting ready to get selected. I said, Grand Mulligan, you've got a messenger outside. Well, outside. Yes, a guy. Big envelope. He says, sir, I've been told to deliver this to you. I walk in. Guy finished the conference that morning. We break for lunch. And as we break for lunch, I get the head woman guy. I said, I got something for you. Comes over and opens it. I said, here's your contract, signed, sealed, and delivered. The day you put the handbook in my hand, the first one, you got your money. They almost died. Mm-hmm. He couldn't believe it. I mean, I went from being shit to being awesome. Mm-hmm. You know, it was really interesting.
Yes, sir.
And did the word get around the industry fast? I go out to Douglas. I had the same problem at Douglas. Douglas is really apprehensive. Mm-hmm. I said to the Douglas guy, and they know everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these guys, publications, all the ministry, they know everybody.
Yes, sir.
I said, call so-and-so and go talk to him. He got up, he said, listen, if this guy says to do it, do it. He said, he delivers. And that's how we got it done. I had to call.
Yes, sir.
Every time I went to a place, I had a contract in hand. You mm-hmm. know, by the time I got out of that job, mm-hmm. I had job offers from every one of those companies.
Wow.
Yeah. It was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting. I learned a lot out there. Yeah.
But an awful lot of hesitation on the industry's part to participate.
Well, it's changed. Everybody resists change.
Yeah.
And how do I know I'm going to get paid? And,
mm-hmm.
You know. But everybody resists change, mm-hmm. particularly industry. You know, we've always done it this way. My question was, do you ever stop and think you've always done it wrong? It was really interesting.
Yes,
we found a whole bunch of things with it. You know, we've always done it this way. Hey, well, that's the wrong way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? We'll not do it that way anymore.
Yes,
but it was a good experience for me. It was a career-enhancing job.
Mm-hmm.
Worked my tail off, but, you know.
It's fascinating. So it was after that that you went to...
I went to Air Force Staff College, and I went to 36.
Okay.
As an XO, IMA commander, and was an XO 36.
And while you were in the staff college, there was not a discussion of Southeast Asia in all that much detail.
That was a big secret. No.
Right.
We never got anything from any of those speakers from the Westpac that came in. They wouldn't even talk about Vietnam.
Yes, sir.
Okay. At that time, yeah.
How aware were you of the U.S. involvement in Vietnam? And, of course, President Kennedy had increased the American advisory
Just
presence.
A little bit, but then George put the squeeze after the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. Things
yes, sir.
Were quiet.
Yes, sir.
I mean, real quiet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Very, very quiet.
What did you think of the Gulf of Tonkin incident when you heard about it?
Well, you know, I remember when I heard about it. I was driving back from the western part of Virginia with my wife, and some of my kids had been camping. My two oldest kids had been camping. My brother was with us. Came over with a radio. When he passed that Gulf of Tonkin radio, I said to Louise, you know, that's a bad sign.
Hmm.
And the reason I thought it was a bad sign, historically, the country had never done anything like that for the President of the United States. And I hate to say this, but I really didn't trust Lyndon Johnson, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I voted for him, which is the biggest mistake I ever made when he ran,
mm-hmm.
and because I didn't really realize what was going on in Vietnam at the time. And when I get back home, one of the first things I did was sit down and write a letter of apology to Barry Goldwater when he's in the Senate. The first thing I did.
Wow.
Sat down and said, man, you had your finger on it all the way. Know what's going on. But I thought it was a bad opening. I didn't like the way it was handling. And of course, when I was in Hanoi, see, Jim Stockdale was able to expound on the whole thing. He was there, and he says, a big bunch of BS. And he told the guys from Washington, mm-hmm. and they wouldn't believe him, and he said, keep quiet, okay? They sent a couple guys from Washington out to talk to him. He was the only one flying. He said there were no PT boats out there at that time.
Wow.
Okay. You'll find that, I think, in his book.
Mm-hmm. That he talked about it.
Oh, he talked about it to us, yeah.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
How did that affect, it's kind of getting ahead of where we are, but how did that affect morale when you guys learned that kind of fabrication, or apparent fabrication, was going on?
Well, that, you know, that was the early part of that was in 64. Right?
Yes, sir.
So, you know, we're talking about, by the time I found out about it from Stockdale, it's 71 or 72, by the time I'm with Stockdale, and we can talk and
mm-hmm.
you know, stuff. Up until that time, we're in solitary and, you know, through the wall stuff.
Yes,
so we got this with Stockdale when I was with the three Air Force colonels,
mm-hmm.
and then Stockdale and Denton and me and Jenkins at Rutledge and a kid by the name of Hughes that they stuck in with us. You know, emotional problems. They couldn't keep him under control, so they stuck him in with us. But we were the head chefs, except for Hughes. Mm-hmm. We ran the whole show, you know, all senior people. Mm-hmm. And that's what Stockdale talked about, this thing. Mm-hmm. And that was in 71, 72.
Yes, sir. But I mean, but it was the whole premise for U.S. military escalation.
But we didn't know that at the time. By the time we were up there. See, what we knew that most people didn't know, at least back in the States, was that the wall was being run from Hanoi. It was not a bunch of peasants running around in the South, okay, in black pajamas. A bunch of North Vietnamese regulars running around in black pajamas in the South, okay? And we were aware of that.
Okay. Well,
so I always felt in my part of the world that we were fighting the Russians, the Chinese, and the North Vietnamese Communists. Well, that's what I looked at. And I was very pissed off that Johnson didn't have enough guts to let us go fight him because he kept putting our arms behind our back and selecting the targets to run into all the rest of that stuff. It was really frustrating.
Yes, sir.
Caused us to lose a lot of people.
And you witnessed this yourself very early in the war when you were flying.
Yeah.
There were restrictions and
targets. Right away, 65. Mm-hmm. Since I was there, there were all kinds of restrictions. Listen, we couldn't fly within 15 miles of Haiphong, 25 miles of Hanoi. We could look in there and watch them put the missile sites up. Okay? You can see them. All right?
Mm-hmm.
Then they started picking us off because they had them other places where we couldn't see them. We kept losing planes here and there. Didn't know why we were losing them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, pick one off here and there. It was the back end guy.
Well, let's go ahead and talk about your transition to flying over Southeast Asia. When did you get your orders, and was this something you volunteered for? Or?
Oh, well, my squadron.
Okay.
We got transferred from my squadron and another squadron.
Okay.
76 got transferred from the East Coast, and we were assigned to CAG 9 on the Enterprise. The Enterprise was an East Coast ship at that time, but it was going to become a West Coast ship after the Vietnam cruise.
Yes, sir.
Sail around. So we picked up the ship here. I was out of Jacksonville. I had just got back from the Med a month before on the Saratoga, so I came up here and picked up the Enterprise.
Okay.
We actually got back in July, but when we picked up the Enterprise in September. Mm-hmm. Over here, we went up from here, went down, and worked our way. We went around Africa and over to South Africa.
Okay. When did you arrive in Southeast Asia?
Early November.
Early November?
Mm-hmm.
And did you know when you arrived what types of missions you would be flying?
Not immediately. We weren't sure. We went as soon as we got over. We worked in the South, and we worked with the port air controllers in the South.
Okay.
To warm up the first day or two.
Mm-hmm.
Then we went north, and then we had a couple of Alpha strikes. The very first one was on the power plant at outside of Haiphong, and then Haidong Bridge. I was in the second one.
Okay.
CO and I alternated them.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we looked. We took some losses on both those.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, the objective of the game certainly up north. Immediately, the first thing we did up north was road wrecking and attempt to stop the trucks going down at nighttime. Okay. It's a very frustrating. Okay. Man, stop thinking about it. Now we're flying around at nighttime in bad weather with our ride balls.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a radar to pick up trucks and A4s. Okay, running through the mountains looking for trucks. In the daytime, these Russian ships would go sailing past us, 5 miles in the back of the Enterprise, load with trucks, take them to Haiphong, offload them where we couldn't touch them, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then we were supposed to catch them on the roads on the way down. Hey, you know what I mean?
It's not making a lot of sense.
Here? First guy we lost over there flew into a mountain first night.
Oh, wow.
And four guys. XO, CO, XO, XO, CO, XO, subscriber. Really sad. But, you know, it was very frustrating.
Yes, sir.
And
was this a topic of conversation a lot amongst the pilots?
Yeah, we thought it was stupid, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had the bombing pauses off and on. We're bombing up north. Oh, we can't bomb up north. Had to fly around the DMZ and go up and work in Laos. Try to catch trucks on the Laos and trails. Then it'd be back off again, and we'd be up north again. We didn't have many good targets. And we had a few, just a couple of Alpha Strikes. And then Johnson pulled back.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he was spotting him with his wrist and pulling this back. And, you know, it's not the way you run a military war.
No. Okay. Well, I'm curious, what did you think about the political concerns that, you know, Johnson must have been thinking about in terms of the Chinese and the Russians? And, you know, here we have a very similar situation to what happened in Korea. And there was obvious a concern that if you get too close to the Chinese border, there's the potential that you'll draw Chinese ground forces in instead of just having support coming down in terms of material support. Did you guys think that that was a legitimate concern at all? That you didn't want to draw the Chinese really heavily into the war?
I never really thought that much about it. I'll tell you why, because I felt that, in the first place, the Vietnamese and Chinese don't get along.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And the Chinese gave them a lot of support. They gave them a lot of support with anti-aircraft guns and a lot of support in road building and stuff, that type of thing. The Russians gave them the SAMs and the high-tech stuff. But I didn't think that that there was much of a threat of a Chinese army coming down in that part of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I thought that the U.S. should have wiped these guys out completely and pushed them right out of South Vietnam and bombed the hell out of... The key to success was Hanoi.
Mm-hmm.
And Nixon finally did it with 10 days of bombing the B-52s. Mm-hmm. And that night that happened, as soon as I heard those bombs go off that night. If you've ever heard B-52s drop bombs, mm-hmm. If you heard it one time, you'll never forget it. I heard it one time. It's Eglin Field in a big firepot demonstration in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Ray dropped, I don't know, 81 of these bombs come down at one time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, you go, from the earth, you hear it one time, you don't forget.
Mm-hmm.
That night in the 18th of December, I first went in and I said, it was Harry Jenkins checking out the back window to see what's going on, firing Sam's. I said, Sam's. Harry, pack your bags, the goddamn B-52s were going home. Because I knew as soon as they started B-52s, they wouldn't stop. They couldn't stop once they made that commitment. And that's exactly what, and it's real interesting. We sent Nixon a copy of my book. He wrote me a nice letter, which I have back there. Mm-hmm. Dear Captain Mulligan, thank you so much for the book, etc. I immediately turned to your description of the 10-day bombing of Hanoi. He says, my one regret, I didn't do it 4 years sooner. Okay?
Well. Wow.
And the other thing was at the POW convention down in Austin.
Yes, sir.
Nixon, when he was speaker down there.
Mm-hmm.
Sam was in the House of Representatives down there at that time. Nixon shut the door and talked about, and he said, when I gave the order to bomb, he said the Air Force didn't want to. He said, we got all these targets and all these Russian targets and all this type of stuff. And he said, you stand there, stand down from every damn one of those targets. He said, you get every damn B-52 you can get, and you get to get it rolling, and you start bombing, and you don't stop bombing until I tell you. Okay? He told us that. They didn't want to do it.
Why do you think the Air Force was so reluctant that late in the war?
Well, I think at that period of time they were concerned about nuclear weapons and mm-hmm. all the targets they had all over the world and all that stuff. And Nixon said, wait a minute, that's not the problem. The problem is there, let's do it.
Yes, sir.
Okay, and then they said, we don't want to take the resource, do it.
Mm-hmm.
And the President of the United States says, do it, and you're going to do it.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. It was his gamble.
That's fascinating. Well, when you started flying your missions, you said the first thing you do is you flew a couple of missions in the south.
Yeah, we warmed up in the south.
Fat control.
Forward air control. Yeah.
What was that like?
Well, these guys, they had various types of skirmishes going on down there, and the guy would, he would have some people pinned down, and he would fire a, he'd call us up and say, in fact, he'd call us up and say, I got some bad guys here, and he would put a smoke rocket in and mm-hmm. say, and we'd drop the bombs on
mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay. Just standard bomb runs. What kind of weapons would you carry? What kind of munitions?
Well, just ordinary bombs, 500-pound bombs.
Okay. Yeah. How many could you fit on your aircraft?
Well, it depends on what multi-racks, okay.
Mm-hmm.
non-carrying, but we could carry eight. If you had centerline, if you didn't have centerline tank, you carry more than you carry 12.
Okay. Yeah. And was the...
We were using World War II bombs. Bombs, yeah.
Okay. And was the aircraft well-suited to this particular type of mission?
Yeah, okay. A4 was, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you could drop ordnance fairly close to targets?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
It's a good bombing target. Good bombing platform.
Yeah. Okay. And then you started your bombing runs up in the north, primarily on trails coming down south.
Well, we had some Alpha targets. Alpha targets are big targets, a major bridge or power plants or something like that. Mm-hmm. But and those were very heavily defended. Mm-hmm. But we only had a... You know, in the time I was there, we only had two major Alpha targets, and then they pulled us back. Okay. And those were in December, and they pulled us back off the Alpha targets. But we still had the responsibility of road wrecking and all that type of stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, truck parks, anything you could find that way.
And these were mostly night missions or day missions?
Night and day. We flew around the clock.
Around the clock. Yeah. What was the typical flak you guys would have to take when you're flying over North Vietnam? Small arms or 50 cal or...
Oh, over North Vietnam? Mm-hmm. Well, you got everything. If you were alone, you got small arms and AK-AK. You got AK-AK all over the place. Okay. Missiles, too. Mm-hmm. Well, we were just picking up on the missiles. Mm-hmm. Missiles were really... When I was shot down, I was going on a little rinky-dink... road recce deal, which they said they thought there was a little bridge there, but they weren't sure. And it was one of these map deals. So, and they said, well, I said, well, if there's no bridge here, what do you want? Created the road. Well, you know, that's bullshit. But as I was leaving, an intelligence guy came in and said, oh, by the way, listen, he said, the Air Force said that they thought they heard a SAM come up yesterday, down here someplace, and that's where I was, in that area. We hadn't seen any SAMs down there. And so I said to the guys, well, hell, if this possibly a SAM, let's change the deal. Let's go in low level, and we'll pop up, hit the deal. And I said, and if there's a SAM down there, I had a new guy with me, three of us. So I'll make the run in, I'll pop up, I said, and run in, hit the target. I said, well, when I'm doing that, I said, you guys look around. If you see any dust or anything, look for Sam, lift off. And if anything's lifting off, that's your target, okay? So we go running in, and I'm at 100 feet, okay, across the beach. And I use electronic people to put me right on target. The guys are in my ready room. Mm-hmm. I said, hey, give me a run in, put me right on. And I was up across the beach, and I got about... I'm 2 minutes from the target when I flew over a battalion of North Vietnamese and somebody hit me with a rifle. Knocked my controls out to one spot, and I'm 100 feet, 475 knots, 100 feet off the deck, stick and stung. All I had was electrical trim tab. I couldn't move stick. And tree coming up, so I hit the trim tab and going straight up, and I can't turn. Can't do it. I'm climbing up like this. You know, 2 minutes early, my wingman calls up saying, hey, so you're pulling up 2 minutes. Well, 2 minutes early. He's talking, I can't talk. About this stage of the game, I got a flak warning light, come on. Going straight ahead. One off the right, one right through the cockpit, hit me right in the chest, and one behind me. And I'm still going straight ahead. Of course, now I'm on fire. Mm-hmm. Got fire warning light. Also got broken ribs because it hit my radio. Whatever it was, busted my heart. But I'm still going right ahead, and I'm at that stage. I got a missile tone. I need missiles coming. Okay. And I still can't turn. I can't do anything. The only thing you can do is you do a manual and disconnect. Mm-hmm. When you disconnect, all your control services go manual. But to do that properly, should be straight and level.
Yes, sir.
300 knots, or less 250 knots. Well, I'm going up like this, like a bat out of hell. I have to disconnect. As soon as I disconnect, the airplane spun. No controls, and the stick was still stuck. I couldn't move. So I checked.
Yes, sir.
Knocked out cold. But I got hit by this missile, so I got shot down. It was the first scratch I had on my 80s. Up to that time, I hadn't had a scratch. My guys come back, holes all over the place. I didn't have nothing. Hit by a damn $3.50 rifle. Hit by flak. hit my gun aimers. And I found out because that day, after I got captured right away, mm-hmm. he stuck me in the house, and right near the missile site. I saw the missile site when they took me to this place. I saw the electricity going. I said, what's that? And I could see the camouflage mm-hmm. in there. Put me in the house. And somebody made a run on that missile when I was in there, because they brought those guys out to see me. Mm-hmm. And they were all looking at me and type of stuff. And all of a sudden, I heard the... And two SAMs go off, and these guys went running like mad, and you know, all hell broke loose. I don't know, a whole bunch of planes flew right over the top of me and dropped bombs all over the place. Mm-hmm. And they dragged my ass out of there, so I never did see what happened. I certainly got that sight.
We didn't have any harm at that point, did we?
Any what?
Harm missiles?
No, we didn't.
The anti-radiator missiles?
No, that's this, you know.
That's later.
That's A6s later on.
Yes, sir. Yeah. Well, when you were captured, how long did you stay on the ground before you were captured, when you were ejected?
I was knocked out. I came to in a chute, a couple hundred feet in the air. Mm-hmm. Didn't know where I was. It was black, and it was gray, then it was blue. You know, it was blue sky, and I could see the ocean. So I was trying to see out there. Mm-hmm. I couldn't get to it, of course. And I heard this noise, spit, spit, spit. And I said, oh, a little bastard is shooting at me. My left arm was on backwards and broken stuff, and so shoulder was. I reached up and grabbed the riser so I could swing. Oh, made a bit of time. I hit the ground, knocked myself out, and ended up on my back with my backpack, and my head out of the water. I always thought I was just stunned. I found out later on, and when I came back home, I met two of the kids who were fighter pilots at the time, covered me. We're flying for America, and I met them at Red River Rats Convention in mm-hmm. 1973. And he said, shit, you were out for 25 minutes, and we ran out of gas. We had to leave you. He said, you know, you're just lying there. And they left, and my wingman left. And I saw my wingman. I came to and saw my wingman leaving. I waved, and he didn't see me. And right as he left, that's when the first Vietnamese came up with a burp gun, and from you to me, but he popped up, and I was captured.
Yes, sir.
When I was lying on my back, final land, landed the other way, I'd been dead.
Yes, sir.
Just like.
And you were taken from there and immediately taken to Hanoi?
Well, it took some time. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you how long. Because mm-hmm. I can tell you the first day or two, and then I have amnesia for 8 or 9 days.
Okay.
And I wake up the 20th of March, and I can remember maybe the 20th, the 21st, it started the 22nd, and the next thing I wake up, it's the 1st of April when I'm in the hospital, and the doctor says, you know what day it is? You know, when you shut down, I told him, he says, well, it's only the 1st of April. He says, 2 o'clock in the morning. He spoke English well, too. So from the 1st of April, I can remember, but I can't remember what happened in between then.
Okay. And I think we should say, just so anybody who listens to this is aware, that all of your experiences as a POW, you cover in your autobiography, The Hanoi Commitment. And so anybody who's interested in learning more about that, they should definitely read your book.
The Hanoi Commitment?
Yes,
right.
Sir.
Yeah. 298 pages of authentic losses. I lose on every page except the last one when I come home.
Okay. Yes, sir. Now, I'm curious, is there... Since you wrote your book, is there anything that you thought of that you didn't cover, or is there something that you knew you weren't going to cover for your book that we could discuss today with regard to your captivity?
Well, you know, I was there 7 years, so I have only covered the highlights, really.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
In my book, in my book, it's a personal story. It's just what happened to me,
yes, sir.
Which I told as honestly and as directly as I can, as it was. And I've been told by some guys who I really respect, who said, you know, we like your book because it's straight.
Hmm.
It's 100% straight. No, I don't think there's anything really that I want to cover. I cover it in my book pretty good about what happened to me. I always tried to do my best to get good treatment from the guys. I demanded treatment. I stuck my own butt out a lot of times and got hammered for it.
Mm-hmm.
for being very aggressive with the Vietnamese. They didn't like me at all. Mm-hmm. I had the wrong personality. Of course, I didn't understand Asian, so half of it's my own fault. But as far as the book, Hanoi Commitment, it covers pretty much the things I want to cover. Of course, there's so many other things that aren't in there because it's just a massive time frame. And I covered it pretty thoroughly. Mm-hmm. I didn't really criticize as much as I would like to the handling of the war by Johnson and McNamara. Mm-hmm. I covered it some, but my own gut feeling, I have a very, very bad taste in my mouth for a lot of Vietnam that I think was misrepresented, either intentionally or unintentionally by misinformed or ill-informed. The best and the brightest have disappeared from the scene these days, as far as I'm concerned. Nobody talks about those guys anymore. They've gone on to bigger and better things, I don't know what, but I think they missed a lot of what was going on. I think if you have a historical perspective of Vietnam, you have to put it smack in the middle of the Cold War, and you can't take it out of there. If you take it out of there, I think you've missed it completely. Mm-hmm. Don't give me any of this garbage about the Vietnamese peasants fighting to be free. If that were so, then we wouldn't have had literally hundreds of thousands of boat people walking the water to get out of there when the U.S. Congress abdicated its responsibilities and walked out. I was a born Democrat. I was a raised Democrat. I voted for Truman. I voted for Adlai Stevenson. I voted for Jack Kennedy. I voted for Jimmy Carter. And I'll never vote for another Democrat again. Okay.
Well, before you left, what kind of survival training had you received?
Well, I went to the Navy Survival School up in Brunswick, Maine, and I went up there in February or March in the middle of the snowstorms. So up there, so it was a good survival. The good training I got up there was not the survival, was the compound training was quite good. I got some good information from some of the guys up there who said, you know, always remember you're smarter than your guards, and remember that the key guard is he's got a job to do, so don't mess with him. He's got to get you your food and that type of deal. And I picked up some good things there, and the fact that the Navy taught the hard line, and that's the way I wanted it. Mm-hmm. Name, rank, serial number, date of birth. Okay. Don't give them anything for nothing, right? You can't play games with them. They exploit you home. You can only hold out so long, okay? And you're going to lose when we demonstrated that. But, you know, the agreement was you stay in the barrel as long as you can, because when they're working you, they can't work another guy. So code of conduct worked out very good for us. When we came back, there was a big effort to get rid of code of conduct by people in Washington, D.C., and well-intentioned military people, well-intentioned liberal do-gooders in the political scene who said it's too tough. Well, we fought that tooth and nail, okay? So the code of conduct has basically been not changed at all, except the escape clause. Well, we had some guys who felt as though if they didn't escape from Hanoi, that they were violating the code. They didn't understand the real interpretation. The interpretation is you escape if there's a reasonable chance of your escape, okay? Without jeopardizing everybody and everything. Okay? So we learned a lot from that. And I think the present training system is much, much better than it was. No one had prepared anybody for the type of deal that we went through. Long time solitary, no communications, that stuff. At least they're aware of that now.
Yes, sir. Now, when you were first captured, how long was it after that where the TAP code was created and used?
Well, the TAP code was already in use when I was captured. I knew the Morse code, and when I ended up out at the zoo in April of 66, then Freddie Fredericks, a Marine who died up on the Chinese border just before we get out, master sergeant. Freddy taught, and he knew the Morse code, so he tapped me to me using the Morse code, and he taught me the tap code, because the tap code is much faster than the Morse code. On a wall, it's very easy to do. And you can do it a lot of ways. So the tap code is the universal code. And of course, when the guy's in solitary, you know, that's the only way you communicate. You get good at it. Denton and I and Stockdale, Roberts and Jenkins and Johnson, you know, we can communicate as fast as we can talk. Okay. Most of the guys couldn't communicate anywhere near as fast as we can because they weren't in that environment. But when you're stuck alone for years, 3 or 4 years, in solitary, it's the only way to communicate. You get good at it.
So you could converse almost as quickly. That is, you could tap code just as quickly.
We've all got abbreviations, you know.
Congressman Johnson mentioned something about Z being said.
Said. I see you, letter I see you. That meant I saw you. Okay.
Yes.
You look okay, good, GD. Okay, that type of stuff. We had all that torture, TTR, treatment, TRMT. Say, says, or said was Z, you know. WHR, that type of stuff. We used phonetic abbreviations. We developed to be our own little mishmash of English.
And how long was it after you were there that Admiral Stockdale was with you? What was your first interaction with him?
My first direct interaction with Stockdale was at Alcatraz.
Okay.
That was in 1967. He was in the camp in 66, but he wasn't running the camp in 66. Denton was running the camp in the zoo in 66. Mm-hmm. Stockdale had been at, in the Hanoi Hilton in, he was back there for quite a while, and Denton was there, and Denton did the blinking thing. Then he moved him back out. So Stockdale was in the zoo, but he didn't run the zoo. He came into prominence in 67, early part of 67, when they moved us on to Stardust, the old guys and stuff. And he got in, and here's what Johnson is on that time. And, of course, he was senior to Denton by a couple of numbers. They say classmates.
Yes, sir.
But Denton, in the tough years of 65 and 66, Denton ran the camps. Stockdale didn't.
How important was their roles, Denton and Stockdale's, as leaders?
They're important roles.
The morale of the men.
Well, Denton's policy was don't read, don't write. Don't give me anything for nothing. Okay? So when I took over from Denton, don't give me any money. That's where it was. And when Stockdale came up with his back U.S. policy, that was in 67, and of course that was just an extension of it. And that was so we'd get the word out to all the guys around all the camps. So, you know, it worked out pretty good. We only ended up, added 2 guys we didn't get back. We had the other 7, which 5 of them came back into the good graces, and then 2 of them decided not to, but out of 340 something guys, that's pretty good.
That's right.
Yeah. But the leadership is important in that you have to. The significant thing about the leadership, okay, which was quite an embarrassment to the Air Force, was that it was all Navy leadership. Okay. General Flynn and General Gaddis and General Wynn. And come me, okay, those guys should have been running camps. They couldn't even get in the ball game until 71, until they stuck them with us. And up until that time, it was all Navy commanders leading, okay? Johnson was 2 junior, and the other Air Force colonels were retired on active duty except Reisner, and he was spun off. Reisner couldn't lead because he wasn't there. They got him off, they spun him away. Reisner's a good guy. But there was several other, a whole bunch of other light colonels that were floating around. They floated around. Of course, we had a few commanders float around too.
That's okay.
But the majority of them, the majority of the commanders held up pretty well. When you look at Alcatraz, we stop and think the Alcatraz deal, Todd. You got Johnson, McKnight, and Storrs. That's 3 out of 11. Okay? The ratio of Air Force guys to Navy guys is almost 3 to 1. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, in touch where you get ready in leadership, where's your leadership come from? Who are the Vietnamese afraid of? Who are they afraid of? You know?
Mm-hmm.
They identify leaders. They know who the hell is causing them trouble. That's mm-hmm. what the show.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite interesting. It was quite an interesting deal. Yeah, Sam Johnson's a great guy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, how would you cope with or deal with Americans who didn't subscribe to the back U.S. policy that was developed?
I didn't ever bump into anybody to subscribe to except the outer 7, and then we got the 5 of them back, and the two guys didn't. And you know, what can you do? We would have court-martialed them when we got back here. Stockton's going to court-martial them, but the DOD and Secretary of Navy, John Warner was Secretary of Navy, then, decided that they should only get letters of reprimand. They were allowed to retire, and both of them, Navy commander and Marine major, Marine colonel, like so, Miller and Wilbur.
Mm-hmm.
They should have been court-martials.
Yes, sir.
Okay. But that's the way it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, what other things helped you cope with the stresses of being a POW?
Being a POW, my education, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I was liberally educated, scholastically.
Mm-hmm.
Basically a history major on a philosophy and ethics. Code of conduct fits in.
Mm-hmm.
To my value system, okay?
Yes, sir.
The democratic processes in this country fits into my value system. That's where I'm coming from.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I fought for, and that's what enabled me to survive, my family values,
mm-hmm.
my Christian values. I'm a church-going person. Mm-hmm. I happen to be a Roman Catholic, but I'm a follower of Christ. That's what it comes down to.
Okay.
And that helped me, particularly in solitary. Solitary is typical.
Yes, sir.
I would rather take physical torture in Hanoi than take solitary. Okay?
Yes, sir.
And it's real interesting. There aren't many guys that had a lot of solitary. Sam and I had 3.5 years or so. And then Howie and Harry Jenkins and Denton and Stockdale. And I don't know how much Rice I did next. Maybe Rice. I had close to 4 years, okay? And when Rutledge did a study paper when he came back in school,
mm-hmm.
and he evaluated the repercussions of solitary and torture and stuff, that all the guys who had long-term solitary all said the same thing, individually. They'd much rather take physical torture than be in solitary for an extended period of time. When you get in solitary for years, you have problems. Solitary. And sometimes you have communication, sometimes you don't. Sometimes I would have communication once a day for a half hour or so for 3 or 4 months in a row, and it's difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Very difficult. Solitary is very difficult.
What was the longest time frame that you went without any communication whatsoever with anybody? Do you remember?
Without anyone. I think probably 6 or 7 weeks. Yeah. And that was hard.
Yes, sir.
Without any type of communication. I've had minimal communication. I mean, sometimes you're talking 5 or 10 minutes a day in 24 hours. Okay. Mm-hmm. And at Alcatraz, at one time, because I was spun off in a building by myself, and they moved Stockdale away, and then I got tortured really bad the week he moved, and I got a week of torture, and then they threw me back out there. I could only flash tap with Storrs and then with Tanner a little bit. So it was quiet. I didn't even, I just flashed a shadow of my hand type of deal. And I didn't have a quiz with the gooks for months and months and months.
Mm-hmm.
And one day they brought me the quiz. I could barely talk. I didn't use my voice at all. He said, what's the matter? You don't speak. I didn't speak because I hadn't use my voice.
You know? Yes, sir.
Made some noise, you're going to get slammed in the kitchen or something, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It was a difficult. Solitary is difficult. Difficult things were when you were sick, too. Okay. Because you could get pretty sick. We had a lot of. I had dysentery. That's. You know, you don't want to die and you can't die. You know? You know, that type of thing. You don't give up on yourself. The main thing, you don't give up on yourself. And the main thing about Reisner's policy was really good. We said we would take torture, but don't take it to the point that it drives you crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So that was, the policy was don't give anything for free. And we never judged anybody whether guys lasted 5 minutes or 5 hours or 5 days. Nobody. Question that.
Mm-hmm.
All we said was do the best you can, okay? Do the best you can on the circumstance because it gets awful rough in there. Awful rough when you're in a battle like that. And they play head games with you, you know, they used to call you out in the middle of the night. They're always bugging me about my family, you know. You'll never see a family, you know. You will never see a family. You will die here. You have a bad attitude. That preys on your mind when you're solitary. That type of thing.
Yes, sir.
Not a pleasant way to live, you know. So you get some sort of deep-seated hate sometimes from those people.
When you were pulled in for quiz, did anybody ever question you about the TAP code?
No, they knew we communicated, but they didn't. You know, it was really interesting. They knew we communicated, but they didn't have any idea of the scope of communications. I would say that they probably figured they knew. I figured they didn't know 5% of what went on.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we got very sophisticated communications. Very sophisticated. We have very sophisticated note communications. Okay, when we encrypted stuff. In the last couple of years, we sent notes to the ties, drilled a hole through the wall, pushing the ties, put the note in, put it in a stick. The stick was hollowed out, pick it up to the room. So it came from the head shed.
Mm-hmm.
And Harry Jenkins and I and Howie Rutledge would write this stuff out. We have tic-tac-toe code, you know,
mm-hmm.
Tic-tac-toe code. A, is this box right here, that's A, with a dot in it is B. C, dot in it and D.
Mm-hmm.
E, etc. We used semaphore code. We used the clock code, 12 o'clock. So A could be 12 o'clock, B 5 minutes after 12, C 10 minutes after 12. You could make A 9 o'clock or 8 o'clock or mm-hmm. 6, any way you want it. Just so it's set up. So we had a very sophisticated code system. Well, we could write it out. We lost the semaphore code. They intercepted the semaphore one time. We never used it again. So they picked one up, so we never used it again.
What happened when they picked it up?
I don't know. They picked it up, they got it. How they got it, and I don't know how they got it, but they grabbed a hold of it. And I'm sure they never figured out what the hell was on there.
Mm-hmm.
But we never used the semaphore. And it was real interesting the way they did the codes. We took a message, we wrote the message out, okay? Then we reversed it. Went from backward to forward. Then we encrypted it with 33 characters per line. 33 characters per line,
mm-hmm.
okay? And you made 33 characters all the way down, okay? And then when you get to the bottom line, you ended up with Z's, okay? So we evened it out.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the guy they had to decrypt it, when they got the message, okay? For example, that's the way we wrote it, but the way we encrypted, like when we used Monday, up one for Monday, up two for Tuesday, up three for Wednesday, up four for Thursday. So A, if I sent you an A on Monday, okay, I sent a B. I wrote the letter B, mm-hmm. up one. You got it a B on Monday. You knew I sent it up one. You downed it one. You had to read it a B. You got a B, but you translated it to an A. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Tuesday, okay. I'd send a C, okay. You got a C on Tuesday. It was an A. And we went 1, 2, 3, 4 Thursday, and then down one on Friday. I'd send a Z on Friday. You'd get it. It came up one. You'd read an A. Okay. So that's why we did it, and we reversed it. Mm-hmm. And it was really interesting. And when we got back, Jenkins and Rutledge, who were really outstanding communicators, were in Washington, and the people up in Washington were very concerned about that. And they gave them a bunch of hell about saying, you guys were taking high risk, all this type of stuff, and risk, you were taking too many risks and this type of deal. So they sat down, walked out of the room. Harry says, I'll write one this way, you write one that way, we'll give it to him. I gave it to him. I said, here, we're going back to San Diego, call us when you got it. He never got it. They didn't have enough samples. They didn't know what they were doing.
Right.
That's what we figured at the same time. Mm-hmm. So communication was very, very sophisticated. Mm-hmm. You know,
was, but you were never questioned about it. I mean, the Vietnamese knew
they
that
you
tortured
you. If they caught you, they tortured you.
Right. Yeah. But they tortured you to find out the code.
No, they knew the code.
Okay.
They knew the tap code. They knew the Morse code. No. They tried to catch. They couldn't catch us on the tap code because they didn't know the shave and the haircut. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
See, you're in a cell as big as this table. Okay.
Okay.
There's a cell next to you, and there's a cell next to you. Okay. Mm-hmm. Denton's here. Johnson's here. Okay. I know they're there.
Mm-hmm.
Denton goes out to quiz. He comes back. Okay. When he comes back, I never tap to him. I always pay him to tap to me.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Pretty soon I hear. I'll sit there like this. Hey, Denton. I'm sitting there and I'm waiting for him, okay?
Yes, sir.
They never knew what it was. They knew we did something. They would try to get it and they could never get it. You know, sit there, you wouldn't move, you know?
Oh, wow.
As soon as it was safe, anytime you went. You cleared the area first. When you clear the area, you look for shadows and stuff, and you go, okay. You sat there. The other guy, he looked for shadows. As soon as it's clear, he comes back. Mm-hmm. And you start, okay. And they went bananas. They tried to set you up, put a guy next to you. And if you were dumb enough, you hit that wall once when he hit, and you went, boom, they came in. Strapped you and I to wheel your tire out of you, okay? You got caught communicating. They got you. Okay.
What were the walls constructed of?
Mostly concrete. Cinder block concrete. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kind of where you were, but that's where it was mostly in the Hilton and the Alcatraz.
Mm-hmm.
But you can tap with the heel of your hand. And a concrete block, and find a little place that'll vibrate, and you can put your ear right in the wall, and put a cup on your cup on the ear, and you can hear the vibration. And a guard can be standing right next to the wall, and he can't hear anything. Okay? I used to tap right through the guard. The guard would be in the next cell to me. Tap the stock, you know. Just hit it. How do I get it? Oh, here's it. Mulligan's coming up. He listens. And you get the ball vibrating. It's not ready to make any noise.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but you can hear it.
So you communicate with coughs and...
Oh, yeah, well, I was Denton was the cough code. That was a magnificent way of communicating at nighttime.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
One cough, for A. Two coughs, for B. C. Throat clear. Four. Hack. And five. Spit. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So Denton would be, that's a D.
Mm-hmm.
That was his call. And if I went in a building and I heard, I knew Denton was in that building.
Mm-hmm.
If I went in a building and he heard, 3-2, that's Mulligan, M. That's how we knew each other. We had to do it slow and never get caught.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty interesting.
How long did that code of communication take to develop? I mean, I would imagine it was just an ongoing thing.
Well, yeah,
constantly evolved.
Alcatraz, Denton came up with it because they were running us at night, you know. Mm-hmm. Put you out at night and for a couple, you couldn't tap at night. Mm-hmm. I mean, we couldn't, me and Stockdale couldn't because it couldn't flash. Okay. The other guys could tap on the wall to each other because they were there. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if Stockdale and I went out to quiz, there was no way we could tell anybody what was going on. We were across the area from them. Mm-hmm. The problem was, guys were going to quiz, and we didn't find out until the next day. And you don't know what's going on. So the big thing is to find out what they're doing. See, if it's a BS quiz, a bullshit quiz, okay, you go to sleep. Okay, but if people are getting tortured and they're running a program, you kind of want to be on edge. You are on edge. Let's face it, you might be next, okay?
Yes, sir.
So you want to know that. So the quiz was, they came to my room, okay, told me to get dressed. As soon as they did that, I went, 4-1 quiz, okay?
Mm-hmm.
M, that's Mulligan.
Mm-hmm.
I don't do that later on, so now you know it's Mulligan's going to quiz. Come back from quiz, as soon as I, might be an hour, might be 2 hours. If I went, that's a B. Okay, mm-hmm. Now they're waiting for the next one. Because if I give them an I for BI, that meant torture. Or if I gave them an S for BS, that meant bullshit. Mm-hmm. They don't hurt anybody tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Well, most of the times they don't hurt anybody. But if they're not hurting anybody, everybody go to sleep, because they don't worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you've got the I, then you get ready, because you know the next guy's going to, because he's going to get hit. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So that was the advantage of, that's what Denton came up with. That was a great bit of framework on his part.
Yes, sir.
Because it saved us a lot of anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when we were getting run badly. You know, at nighttime, people come and go, and you know what's going on in the middle of the night. Sometimes you're getting tortured, sometimes you run, pretty soon you get the shakes, you know?
Yes, sir.
Particularly when you're in the condition we were in.
Mm-hmm.
So those are some of the things that went on.
Did you ever interact with many enlisted men as a prisoner? The American enlisted prisoners?
No, we only had a couple up there, and I was never run.
Mm-hmm.
You had Billy Robinson and they got battlefield commissions. They came back, they gave battlefield commissions.
Okay.
Because yeah. They put them through the Housakana School there.
Mm-hmm.
In the camp, last 2 years. I'll have to think. Hegdahl left. Hegdahl left. I didn't have been around Hegdahl.
Mm-hmm.
He knows me and I know him well. He's a great kid.
Mm-hmm.
He's the one that came home with the names. He was sent home. The rest of the guys that came home were sent home, you know, finked out and came home. There were 10 or 12 guys that came back.
Mm-hmm.
On their own. But Hegdahl didn't. Hegdahl was sent home. He was a good guy. But we didn't have, we only had three, Hegdahl and Billy Robinson. And I'm not thinking, so I can't pop up the...
Just curious. Yeah, it didn't seem to be very...
Very
frequent.
No,
contact between officers and enlisted.
Well, there weren't any there.
Right.
Up there.
Most of them were pilots.
They're all pilots.
Yes,
sir. Well, now the two enlisted men we got up there, two of them were from a helicopter rescue. They only got shot down in November of 65.
Mm-hmm.
And Hegdahl fell off the ship.
Mm-hmm.
He fell off the ship and got picked up.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, the enlisted guys were down south.
Mm-hmm.
And then they moved some of them up north. Yes, but they weren't with us.
So. How about American civilians?
Well, they moved those up north, too. Mm-hmm. We didn't have any up north. We didn't have any contact with them.
You didn't have any contact with civilians?
No.
Okay.
They moved them up right at the end. They moved them up. They moved mm-hmm. some of them up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we didn't have any contact with those guys. They were kept in a different camp, different place. The plantation, I think, at the end.
Okay.
But there weren't that many of them.
Mm-hmm.
Half of them died on the way up, I think. Yeah. But Connie's book, on about it, that's, you want to read that, because
mm-hmm.
that covers all of Rochester and Connie, on about that, is the book, you've got to read the book.
Okay.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
that'll fit in on the entire of the guys in the South, and they had some real tough times down there.
Okay.
Holocaust. It's a great book.
Did you ever receive treatment from a Vietnamese that you thought was at least decent while you were in captivity?
Yeah, sure. I was sick one time, and really bad, and I had been kept in leg irons, and I had dysentery, and they let me out to eat, wash up in my cell, and normally you'd be only out for 5 or 10 minutes, but a guy brought me back, a new guy did.
Mm-hmm.
I never saw this guy before then. He kept looking at me kind of funny, and he would look around. He knew I was pretty sick. And
mm-hmm.
One time he pointed at me, and he blessed himself like that. And I said, me? Yeah. I blessed myself. He pointed himself, and he blessed himself like that. And then instead of putting me back in the leg irons, he just shut the door and let me sit there. And I stayed there a couple, 3 hours. And before another guard came and saw that I wasn't in leg irons, and he stopped me in leg irons. I just, just to figure he was a Christian or I was a Christian or something. And you know, I think in a lot of ways, a lot of the BS ended after the treatment changed in 69-70.
Mm-hmm.
It got a lot better. Okay. And I think that was due from outside pressures, the pressure of the wives, the letters, and all that
mm-hmm.
stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And we became of value to them then, up to our time. I don't think that they thought that 260 million Americans would be concerned about 350 PNWs they had at the time. And all of a sudden, they found out he had a hell of a mess in their hands,
mm-hmm.
politically, and Paris and all that jazz. And Ho Chi Minh died, and they reevaluated real fast and said, holy shit, we're going to have to produce these guys one day. So they gave us more food and eased up. And
mm-hmm.
Most of the torture stopped and that type of deal. So,
mm-hmm.
So there were some specific changes. But if you take from 69, 65 to 69, those were tough years.
Mm-hmm.
After that, they reasonably easy, long, boring, frustrating, but not as, you know, in the same atmosphere at all.
Mm-hmm.
No.
And in that later period, were you allowed to at least interact
yeah.
and help pass the time in
yeah.
terms of
well, you had own people with you,
game no. playing and things like that?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Right, see, starting in Christmas of 1900, right after Christmas of 1970, they more or less started putting us together.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that worked out. That made a big difference. So.
Yes, sir.
Big difference. Yeah.
Who you roomed with, or who were you with?
Of course, I was in a room for 47 guys, and we got spun off of that because of church riot. Then I ended up with, I spent 38 days on my back with Jenkins. We were in leg irons, and then I went to Lawrence and Gillespie and Daniels for around 5 weeks, and Jenkins went with Stockdale and Rutledge and Denton, and then they put me and Rutledge and Jenkins together, and then for around 4 weeks, and then they moved me and Rutledge and Jenkins and Denton and Stockdale and Hughes all together opposite the three colonels, whatever, who made general, Wynne, Gaddis, and Flynn.
Mm-hmm.
And the nine of us stayed together, interacted,
mm-hmm.
and ran the camp.
Okay.
Mm.
We'll pause
the key to success was communications.
Mm-hmm.
And the real communicators, and the best communicators in the whole group, and a whole bunch who came. Yeah. Denton, Jenkins, Rutledge, myself, Johnson, Stockdale, a couple other guys.
Okay.
I mean, master communicators.
Mm-hmm.
Impossible to stop those guys from communicating. Okay. Yeah, okay. I'm going to find a way. That's all. So it's really interesting. And you get that down to the guys, and it's pretty easy. We had some guys. We had a couple of guys, you know. I had two guys didn't want to learn to code. Why bother? God. That really upset me.
Yes, sir.
Really upset me. I raised hell with them. They got transferred to another camp. And they didn't know the code when they got their camp. And they got in deep shit out to another camp. Okay? And very soon they learned the code because they had to learn the code.
Yes, sir.
But, you know, why bother? You know, I got a roommate type of stuff. And you go in solitary, my friend, it's a different story, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But most of the guys jumped in right away. You know, they recognize it. You recognize the importance of it pretty fast, okay? And precious.
Well, what did you think upon your return in terms of the POW issue and the MIA issue as it continued to be a very important and controversial issue?
Okay, I'll tell you right from the start. I never thought that we left anybody back in Illinois, up north.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I never thought that the Vietnamese had pulled certain people away from our community. Okay. I still don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's open. That's an open discussion. I don't think so. From every link that I had with anybody up there, they always showed up someplace. Okay. The guys died on the way, and we knew about that. And
mm-hmm.
Guys died in there. I know a guy died one time, and I don't even know who he was. I could about pinpoint when it was. It was August of 1967. And when I was in that solitary, I told you about that long period. I had no communication. One night in the building next to me, and suddenly they had a guy, somebody in there, and I heard this guy. And I had been able to see that somebody was very badly wounded, had been moved in there with something, the Vietnamese had carried somebody in that cell. And I was able just to see that somebody was, a POW of some sort, was being moved in. And that night, I heard the guy crying out, help me, I'm dying, I'm bleeding to death, I'm dying, I'm bleeding to death. So I heard that, and I got up in the window area, and I screamed so I could, bow cow, bow cow, bow cow. And when the guards came, I directed them over there. A whole bunch of guards came, and they moved that guy. I never found out who he was or anything else. I don't have a clue. I do not have a clue who that man was. But, and I was never able to find out anybody else that knew about that man. So I assume that was one of the guys who probably died when he got there.
Yes.
Why, I don't know. Probably not from torture, probably from injuries or something. I don't know.
Yes, sir.
But, you know, but I never felt that there were POWs left up there. And the MIA thing, you know, there were a lot of, you know, Bill Frank was he had his funeral. He was declared dead, and he was a POW. They paid his wife off insurance and everything. Frank and another guy in his back seat. Okay, none of that. Because one of the kids came to us, and I said, "Who's Bill Frank?" "Bill Frank, I went to a funeral last day. Is he alive?" I said, "Yeah, sure." He said, "He's back, paying his wife off insurance and everything." Okay. Well, she's going to be surprised because he's not alive. Yeah, that was kind of messy. You couldn't tell right. And the Vietnamese played a lot of games.
Mm-hmm.
They took IDs, okay,
yes,
of guys who were dead, put them in paper, said they were alive. They never showed up. Okay. So they messed it up, too.
Yes, sir.
Is it possible that they had somebody spun off? Yeah. In my mind, it's a problem. I don't think so. I think they grabbed everybody, processed them the same way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they were that sophisticated. Could have, but I don't think so. That's my
yes, sir. What about the possibility or probability that any were taken to China or Soviet Union?
Well, it's possible. But We know that during Korea that they took people. The possibility exists, the probability, I don't think there's much of a probability. I don't think that they had I don't know what the Russians would have wanted out of people. That they didn't already have.
Yes, sir.
I mean, why would you want to bring people back up there? What kind of intelligence are you going to get out of them? They had more intelligence on us than we did. When I was first in, he asked me how Forrest Peterson spelled his last name. Peterson, S-E-N or S-O-N? He was the XO of the ship. What they didn't know was the last guy I shook hands with when it took off that day was Forrest Peterson. He was leaving the ship and he was getting on the car and he was going to a new duty station. I didn't tell him that. And he wasn't there. They had to line up the ship's officers. They had every officer in my squad. And I said, we don't. Get rid of them officers. He said, no, we don't. We don't need that stuff. Oh, by the way, how does your executive officer of the Enterprise spell his last name? S-E-N or S-L-N Peterson. And your chaplain and so-and-so and your supply officers this way. Oh, you have 17 squad pilots in your squad and intelligence officer and maintenance officer. Maintenance officer? Oh, 2 maintenance officer. You have 2 maintenance officers in your squad. Oh, yeah, you are from the 36th squad. Yeah. Oh, we know you're from the 36th. Yes, you know. Ah, here, from your airplane. Yeah, 36. They have a lineup of 36. They had all stuff. That type of stuff.
That's right.
What he used to get, I guess.
You were never interrogated or questioned by anybody other than Vietnamese?
No. I was interrogated only by Vietnamese. I had one guy that was, we call a pro, was interrogated me, and his guy got very unhappy with me because I gave him a bunch of bullshit. I told him. I was rolling along real bad, and I couldn't fight this guy, so I figured, well, let's see if I can. So I told him I'd write the description of the Rolands and the Palms, and I made a fantastic plot of exactly how we could roll in from such an altitude at the angle, get the right speed. And, I mean, if you're a real professional, you don't write with so much bullshit. But he didn't know that, so I realized that, so I just embellished the whole thing. Let it go. So he thought he had a whole bunch of shit. He must have given it to the Russians or something when they said, you dumb shit. I didn't see this guy for 6 or 8 months. And one night they dragged me into quiz. He took one look at me and said, you. I said, oh, he found out.
Did he hold a grudge?
I didn't see him and he wasn't around that much. I'm sure he would have. But, he was there, and he was doing something. At that time, they were trying to find out what the U.S. would do in Cuba. I don't know why they were wanting to find out Cuba. So we found one of the guys said, they're trying to find out Cuba. And I said, oh, tell them we got thousands of airplanes in Florida all ready to go to Cuba. Okay. Tell them that Jacksonville and Cecilfield's got hundreds of airplanes. We got hundreds of airplanes at Key West and Homestead. And all that. Just tell them. Standing by. Anytime we want to take you around, take about 10 minutes. That's what we did in real life. Well, told that to you. Huh. You're doing it? Oh. Oh, my God. Oh, you ought to see the planes in car. I didn't get a chance to tell this guy that because he said,
oh. Well, is there anything else you would like to discuss with regard to your time as a POW?
No, not really. It was a learning experience, yeah. I suppose. Survival experience. Met some great people here. Great people here.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
How long did you stay in the Navy after you returned?
I came back, picked up a master's in a couple of years and retired.
Okay.
I could have retired when I first got out. But I, because of family and stuff, I didn't want to. I had myself set up even after I got my master's to go up in there. up in Washington. My boss on the Enterprise, Jim Holloway, was in the Chief of Naval Operations. And he had a nice job for me up there. But it was in Washington. It was the head of the Navy liaison in the Senate. It was a pretty nice job.
Mm-hmm.
But I decided not to take it and get out. Mm-hmm. Mainly because, you know, I still had kids at home at school.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of high school, grammar school. And I felt that I didn't need it kind of precious.
Yes, sir.
That the family didn't need it either.
Mm-hmm.
And I was up flying long term. And I was going to fly, and really my flying, the Navy, flying was my real career.
Mm-hmm.
I really wanted to do the Navy. I didn't have any other hopes of being a big burner policymaker or anything. I wanted to fly.
Yes,
that's what I did.
And how long did you fly after you got back?
In the Navy?
Or in commercial capacity,
no,
private license? Or?
Oh, yeah, I flew a little bit, light plane stuff. But that was just for recreation.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, no. I never really got back into aviation big time when I got back. It was just too many other things to do. You know.
What did you think when you got back about two things? First of all, the Paris Peace Accords that were signed, which were, of course, responsible for your release, and then also the fall of Vietnam in 1975.
Well, I never paid any attention to the Paris Peace Accords. I always figured that we were released because of the 10-day bomb.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And if they hadn't bombed for 10 days and blown them apart, we'd still be there probably. Okay. Politically, of course, Nixon was out of the scene, Ford was in, left with the bag, and you had Democratic Congress, which was, I think, I don't think they really understood what they did to those people over there. They bailed out on the boat people.
Mm-hmm.
That's almost a disgrace to the country. All the people that were on our side over there, they walked out on them because they didn't want to appropriate the cash and back them up at all. That was, I think, a very, very sad episode in the history of this country, that we didn't fulfill our commitments to the people that we were committed to. And that's the South Vietnamese. You know, thousands of those people didn't make it. Thousands of them did, and they walk on the water here all over the place, and they make great citizens.
Mm-hmm.
But we really bailed out on them, and I think if we had given them any support at all, they'd have hung in there.
Mm-hmm.
I got a feeling. But, you know, you can't do much about that. But the war as a whole, you take it out of the context of the Cold War, you missed it.
Mm-hmm.
You don't understand it, okay? Politically, the Democrats missed it completely. They got in and didn't have enough guts to finish what they got started with. And the best and the brightest and the whiskers. Well, look at McNamara, okay? His recent book. People like me laugh at him, okay? Mm-hmm. McNamara, the guy who was going to build up this McNamara electronic line and defend
mm-hmm.
incoming people from the bushes by dropping out these sensors. You know, that's kind of thinking, fuzzy thinking that came out of Washington. Same type of people who picked on the target, same type of people who made him go in the same direction all the time. Of course, there's a lot of people over there. The lesson of Vietnam was learned well.
Mm-hmm.
Was learned well in the Gulf War.
Mm-hmm.
And you stop and think what happened in the Gulf War. Washington had absolutely no inputs to the fighting of that war.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And what happened? And the press didn't get in the middle of it either.
Mm-hmm.
Which was really good. And as far as I'm concerned, you got to go to war. That's the way you do it. Hey, we'll figure out the First Amendment rights later on for the press. After you win a battle, and you can talk all you want, but get these people out of the goddamn way. Okay.
Yes, sir.
And so, you know, they don't have a conscience. They don't understand the military. They don't understand the military mind. They don't understand the military objectives. And why should you give them a cop lunch to run around all over the front? Okay, forget it. I think the pool system they used last time kept those people under control, gave you information they're supposed to have, and they couldn't screw anything up on anybody. President Bush was smart in that he let the professors go out and win that war. That's all. He didn't tell them how to do it. You know, take what you need and go get it. That's all you want. So, in one way, Vietnam vindicated the military. Okay. So, and I don't think the U.S. military is ever going to have to fight again with one of them. That'd be on its back. Mm-hmm. I don't think people would tolerate it. But those are my impressions, that's all.
Yes, sir. Yeah. Well, you mentioned the McNamara line. I was curious, what kind of information did you receive as a POW concerning major events like, let's see, Johnson's decision not to run for re-election, the Tet Offensive, Johnson's decision not to run for re-election, stuff like that. Would you receive word about those things?
The way we found out about Johnson was very simple. Since today you have... He brought me in a quiz about the 30th or 31st of March of 1968 and said, since today you have no more capability, your President Johnson, he can no longer bomb us. Okay? Hmm. And put the big bombing pause below the 20th parallel or some damn thing, all right? Mm-hmm. And that's all they wanted. That's all they cared. They were, up to last time, they were terrified. The weather was bad and bombing had slowed down, but we kept saying, hey, the weather's going to get good, look out, you're going to get it. And all of a sudden, since today, you have no more capability.
Hmm.
Okay? That was interesting. They read that one. We didn't learn about much. We heard about Nixon running the election with a guy. Nobody knew who the hell this guy Agnew was. And somebody said about Muskie. We heard the word Muskie, and I said, there used to be a guy by the name of Senator Muskovich from Maine. I think he changed his name to Muskie, Ed Muskie later on. But we didn't have a clue. We didn't know the guy went to the moon and back. Mm-hmm. We had no clue. We mm-hmm. had stuff going on. We got, every once in a while, get propaganda film or some news about some anti-war movement that they would put on a camp radio. A message from, you know, Jane Fonda or somebody like that. But we didn't get much information at all.
Do you remember when you heard about the attempt to rescue at Sante? The Sante raid?
Oh, we knew about the Sante raid pretty fast.
Mm-hmm.
Because we heard it.
Mm-hmm.
We were in Stardust at that time. And that was November of 69.
Mm-hmm.
November of 70. And we had never heard a thing up there for years. And there was some shooting, some firing and stuff way off in the distance someplace. And Stockdale, just talked to a smart average guy. He said right away, U.S. must have tried to snatch, hit one of the camps.
Mm-hmm.
Next day, he figured it out. And then next thing we saw in the Vietnamese were hanging up helicopters, pictures of helicopters so they could practice shooting at them, type of deal. And then we heard some noises, and they brought a bunch of people on the other side of the camp.
Mm-hmm.
And then we found that there were a bunch of POWs over there. And I don't know, somebody got contact with a Vietnamese group, and the Vietnamese guys told our guys, told Chai Chan or somebody that the U.S. had hit a camp. And then after that, they brought all the POWs in. So then we knew what it was for. And it was sad because they flew over 225 guys. Didn't know they were there anymore to our camp. Yeah. Now, I went to the Sante Radio and Empire reunion just in last Thanksgiving, so we ended up meeting with those guys. They're nice people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Very interesting.
Well, what do you think about the relationship that's being developed now between the United States and Vietnam and normalizing relations?
I would. If I was Peterson's over there now, and I would hope that we keep... You know, It's a small world, and I think you can make inroads. I don't think that government's going to be able to keep those people under control that long.
Mm-hmm.
If they got opened up a little bit more.
Okay.
They can't stand progress. And once people see progress, they're going to want it more and more. So I'm in favor of it. I don't think the hard line. I just don't think the hard line on sanctions and that stuff, I don't think works at all. I don't think it works in Libya. I don't think it works in Cuba. I don't think it works in Iraq. Okay? Doesn't mean that I wouldn't go out and take care of Saddam Hussein very fast.
Mm-hmm.
Or Castro. Or Gaddafi. Okay? But, you know, the State Department deal of twisting people's arms, that don't work very good. If you want to get their attention, you break their arm off and you beat them over the head with it, okay, and they get your attention.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you don't do that, then find another way. I mean, everybody else is trading with those people except us, so why shouldn't we? Okay, open it up that way.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I don't have any grudge against the Vietnamese people at all. I think they do fine. You take them, and they make great U.S. citizens when they come in.
Mm-hmm.
And work hard, and they go great in school, and they'll contribute, like all immigrants have done in this country.
Okay? Yes, sir.
Give them an opportunity. You take us and put us in this situation, we're going to die in 6 months. We couldn't handle it. Go the other way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you'd be sick. From one thing or another, you have diseases or something. But the governments are, you know, It's not anything that I would advocate, but I think the way to get rid of it is to bring in a whole bunch of citizen robot catalogs and let the people see what they can get.
Mm-hmm.
You know, teach them a little bit about credit cards and stuff like that. So I'm in favor of it because I don't see communism or totalitarianism really appealing to anybody these days.
Mm-hmm.
They felt it was a good system because it brought order to their country.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they used to tell us, you know. We have freedom, but we have order. Okay, but that's all. We have lots of order, nothing else. But I think, the difference between South Vietnam and North Vietnam is civil. The difference even today between Saigon, Ho Chi Minh City, and Hanoi.
Mm-hmm.
Dramatic from what I hear, people from both places.
Yes, sir. Okay. What are the most important things you took away from your experiences as a person, as a father?
I know what I believe in. I know who I am. I know what I fight for. I know what I die for.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's, there's a time here. Things get bad enough, you just put your trust in God and you go for the goal. That's all, you can't do anything else. Okay. And, not compromise your principles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they used to always tell me, okay, it's easy. You know, you don't have to do this. It can be very easy. They only ask you. Nobody will know. Nobody cares. People back in your country, they don't care. Nobody will know. You just make the paper, write the paper, and that type of stuff. I said, I'm crazy. I said, I don't care. Nobody knows. I know. God knows. That's all else. Okay? I know. That's the important thing. Look in the mirror. Get up in the morning and say, yeah, I failed. Sure. How many times have I lost it? All the time. Lost all the battles, but I won the war. I'm still here, and I still believe I always do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's the way it's going to be. So for me, it was a successful tour.
Yes, sir.
Unpleasant on my family and that type of deal. Sad because you miss your family and your kids, that part of your life. Worthwhile because we won the Cold War, and I put it in the middle of the Cold War. My contribution to the whole Cold War was my 31 years of service.
Yes,
sir. If the world is better off for that, then I'm satisfied with that. You know, I think it is.
What do you think we as a nation should take away from our experiences in Vietnam?
Well, as a nation, one of the things we have to recognize the fact that national policy has to be national policy. I mean, you can't You can't let your policy be driven by strident objections of the small groups. If they're pressing consensus of the majority, then they'll do it. And then don't get distracted. And don't treat everything as an individual freedom. Society does have rights. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Society has a right to clean up some of its mess. Individual freedoms are important. Okay. But they're not the most important thing. Okay. In a lot of ways, in society. And we confuse freedom with permissiveness. You enjoy freedoms, you also enjoy responsibilities. Okay? And somehow that's not being pushed across in the school system and in the media today. Okay. And that's kind of sad, because we have a lot of people that don't know what they believe. And if they don't know what they believe, they won't fight for it, they won't die for it. And if you don't believe in it, the democratic system is a very fragile form of government. Okay. It requires a lot of dedication, a lot of self-sacrifice from a lot of people. And particularly, if you look back to the 20th century, what this country has paid in that last 100 years. I wouldn't want to see it thrown away by a disinterested generation that's more concerned with permissive and individual rights. Okay. I don't recognize that somebody paid a price for all these good things. Okay. Mm-hmm. That we enjoy. Not the material things so much as the moral values that the country has, which stands for. The culture is being ripped apart right now. On the verge of political anarchy, moral anarchy, social anarchy, in a lot of ways. Kind of bad, I think. The pendulum in the past has always swung back, and I have hopes that it will be.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think it's probably doing that right now, I hope so. Because I wouldn't want to think that I would go to my grave, but that this grand old experience would collapse from internal.
Yes, sir.
Neglect. Okay? Because people don't take it seriously. We're the sum of our parts, and if the family falls apart completely, the country will fall apart completely. Okay? That's I'm right there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So we have a lot of adjustments to make.
Is there anything else you'd like to talk about today?
No, I think that pretty much covers it today.
All right, well, I'll go ahead and end this officially. This will end the interview with Captain James Mulligan. Thank you very much, sir.